smudge from a balky lighter and a low-hulled smoking tramp blurs the docks. Down Market Street, the fierce moonlight of mercury lamps sanitizes pavements Walt Whitman used to walk. Here Poe and Brockton Brown were stalked by demons through the town, past the dormered brickwork houses of our colonial century, now lavishly restored to federal austerity, where choppers jostle. Wait, I join you, seers of the soul's exile. From Christ Church vaults the pigeons foul, our signers seem to give no sign. But over Wanamaker's lights, Billy Penn extends indulgent arms, still beckoning the Welsh and Mennonites to his green outlying farms.
Dan Hoffman, how come you wrote a hysterical poem at this point?
Well, one would think perhaps that it's an impossible thing to do toward the end of the 20th century. I found, however, that a number of strands of personal commitment in my private life and in the life around me came together and made this poem inevitable. I've been working on it for about 15 years. At first, I didn't know that what I was doing was heading in this direction. I guess it all came together the year that I was the consultant in poetry at the Library of Congress in 1973 and 4. We'd lived in a Quaker community. For now, it's over 25 years. I'm surrounded by the icons that figure in the poem. For instance, the birthplace of the painter Benjamin West, whose painting of William Penn's treaty with the Indians is really the theme of the whole poem, and I use the painting as one of the sections of the poem. His birthplace is just down the street from my house. Even nearer to my house is the painting, one of the 60 versions of the painting A Peaceable Kingdom by Edward Hicks, in which we have in the foreground the Christ child and the ox and the lion lying down according to Isaiah's prophecy. And in the background, we have William Penn and the Indians copied from the West painting of 50 or 60 years before, showing that these two things are parallel. The version of that which I most prefer is hanging in the Friends Historical Library at Swarthmore College, and that's just a stone's throw from where I live. Philadelphia is the city that has been the center of our lives ever since we came here, and I've become a Philadelphian by convincement, as it were, so that the materials were lying around. And William Penn stands on top of City Hall, and he seems very, very remote. He is the forgotten founder. Everyone associates Penn's colonial days with Benjamin Franklin, who invented everything you can lay your hands on. He invented these bifocal spectacles that I'm wearing, and he invented the Franklin stove that we have to go back to for heat. He invented the insurance policy, and he invented the post office, which isn't running nearly as well as another of his inventions, the University of Pennsylvania. So wherever you look, there's Ben Franklin. What did Penn invent? He didn't invent anything tangible like that, but he invented the ideals of democracy, which are reflected in the whole country. Outside this building, there is a quotation from, I guess it's the preamble to the Constitution. We hold these rights to be self-evident, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. They weren't always self-evident. I think Penn, more than any other single man, through the crucible of his own sufferings, guaranteed those rights for everyone who came afterwards. And among the founding fathers, he's the only one who founded a colony 100 years before the Constitutional Convention that was based on those principles. Well, how does one get from these thoughts about a forgotten great philosopher-statesman to writing a poem about him? Well, as I said, I was there in Washington during the reign of our Emperor King, Richard Nixon, who, although the greatest warmonger of our generation, whenever it suited him, presented himself as a Quaker. And I found myself greatly resenting the fact that although he steadfastly refused ever to receive a delegation from the Friends Committee on National Legislation and even hear their point of view, and although he persecuted and prosecuted and branded as subversives and traitors the other persons in the country who agreed with what most of the Quakers felt about the Vietnam War, when his daughter Julie got married, he saw to it that the music played at the wedding was the score from the movie of The Peaceable Kingdom, and whenever it suited his needs, he would present himself as a cousin of the author of the book on which the movie was based, Jessamine West. And, of course, he was a Quaker. At least he was raised a Quaker out in Whittier, California. So I found myself thinking of the ways in which President Nixon was abusing the trust that William Penn had created. And it made me think about Penn, who was a great Quaker and a great leader of men. Well, one might, of course, write a biography of Penn or edit his works. The first edition since 1726 is now being prepared by colleagues of mine at the University of Pennsylvania. The University Press is publishing it. But I didn't do those things because I'm not a biographer and I'm not a historical scholar or editor. As a poet, I found my response to these pressures and opportunities taking the form of a poem. And as it happens, the aspect of Penn's career that seized me was the treaty with the Indians, which seemed to me, in retrospect, to have been apropos in several respects. The treaty with the Indians was a noble gesture, which a later generation overturned, and the story ends tragically in a genocidal campaign against the Indians. Surely the parallel with the Vietnam situation must have been in my mind. And every time we've intervened in another country, it has always been initially with the most high-minded ideals and then pragmatic and self-seeking reasons overturn the idealism, and it usually ends about that way. I found that once I got interested in the subject and started exploring it, that history itself seemed to me to secrete within itself a poem or poems. And for this reason, I take as one of the mottos or the epigrams of this work a statement of Emerson's from his essay, History. Facts yield their secret sense, and poetry and annals are alike. And Emerson also said, America is a poem in our eyes. And I have tried to work toward the realization of these apothegms of Emerson. Therefore, in the poem, I have used as found poems the prose writings of Penn about the Indians. I've used the actual text of treaties. I've set them up as poems, discovering within them their hidden rhythms that gives them vitality as verse. I've used descriptions of the colony by the earliest settlers, two of them. One of them is the religious leader, Pastorius, who founded Germantown, and the other one was a very hard-headed Welshman who was writing a real estate tract. His name was Gabriel Thomas in 1690. I've used legal documents, Penn's frame of the laws for the colony, and I've used transcriptions from the colonial records of palavers between the provincial leaders and the Indian chieftains, and materials of this kind. And around this, I've, of course, imagined a great deal and written many sections that are simply my improvisations. But I've also gone into the Indian side of things. Now, it turns out the Indians around here with whom Penn dealt, we call them the Delawares. They call themselves the Lenni Lenapes. And by a great stroke of luck, a single copy survived into our time of their creation epic. This is rather like Beowulf, of which only one copy survived in some English library. The copy that survived was it consisted of a whole series of pictures, rather like Egyptian hieroglyphs, on maple shingles. No words, just pictures. And these pictures were gazed upon in turn by the shaman or the medicine man, and they served as mnemonic devices that would remind him of the verse he was supposed to sing to accompany the picture. These were given to a doctor who treated some dying Indians in a smallpox epidemic in Kentucky or Ohio, Indiana, in 1820. He passed them on to a very eccentric scientist and antiquarian named Raffinesque, who lived in Philadelphia for much of his life. Raffinesque translated, he also got the got an Indian to tell him what the words were that went with the pictures, and with the aid of a rather primitive dictionary made by 18th century missionaries, Raffinesque jotted down the translation of the Indian words, but it didn't come out as sentences or poetry. This is an uninflected language, and it's been retranslated a couple of times, so that we understood what the significance of this document is, but not its beauty. In the Literary History of the United States, the author of the chapter on American Indian literature referred to this. He said that it has linguistic and historical interest only. But I have myself translated poems from several languages and read many translations of those and other poems, and I know how easily one can be misled about the qualities of an original by an inept translation. And it seemed to me that a work that was as striated with mystery and with wonder and with awe and reverence and the sense of history of a tribe that had wandered from Siberia to the eastern coast of Pennsylvania over 1,000 years and kept an accurate record of its doings, such a work must have literary merit as well. So using a variorum edition of the Indian text, I retranslated sections of it for this purpose. I also incorporated into the poem the paintings of which I've spoken, and I wrote around them invocations urging the painters to paint the paintings that they actually painted, and then commentary afterwards in which I, as the narrator of the poem, interpret what they did. So it's a great mixture of all sorts of things, and some of the language is the language of the law court and the language of business documents and the language of private correspondence and the language of an adventurous crossing of the ocean. It's also the language of mysticism, both on the Indian side and in Penn's case, too.
Do you see Penn as being as having a similar spirit to the spirit of some of the Indians that he signed the treaty with?
Exactly so. I've tried to make a parallel. You've inferred that already. You'll see one raises the question, why did Penn, alone among the founders, establish so just a purpose for his colony? And this is directly the result of his own experiences as a young man, his spiritual dissatisfaction and his convincement to the Society of Friends, his sufferings, their sufferings. So I recapitulate all of this. And that's the aspect of Penn that makes him seem so remote, because all the other founders are essentially quite secularized by the end of the 18th century. Penn is still in the 17th century, where the terms in which liberty of conscience are understood are essentially religious terms. When Penn speaks of liberty of conscience, he means the liberty to pray as you wish, to worship as you wish, without interference from the agency of the state. And if under the Conventicle Act, if five people or more gathered for the purpose of worship under any aegis other than that of the established church, it was not only heresy, it was sedition. We've come so far from having an established church that we forget that religious and civil laws were identical, and if you violated one, you violated the other. Penn went to prison 5 times in the course of his life, and on one celebrated occasion, he guaranteed for the rest of us that in English law, and therefore in American law, every single citizen would forever be entitled to the right of a trial by a jury that was to be neither forced nor coerced by the prosecutor or the judge.
I don't know if you'll agree with this or maybe even understand what I'm saying, and I hope I can make it clear, but I think in some ways it's easy to be bored or distanced from, you know, great historical figures.
Yes.
And even the monuments that are built to them just blend in with all the other monuments of unknown faces or, you know, people seated atop horses. And
yes.
All in all, it usually doesn't mean a whole lot, I think, to most people, and I think I'd include myself in that. So it's interesting to me that you found all this personal relevance in a figure who you see as being a spirit very outside of the outside of the spirit of a lot of other historical figures, of being a spirit motivated by a lot of things that I guess motivate you too.
Well, the reason that Penn is remote is because he's remote in time, and therefore the circumstances that he responded to are not very much like our circumstances, although his responses are very, very relevant to our own rights and liberties. Let me read you a few lines from another section in the middle of the poem that deal with the figure of Penn atop City Hall and our sense of his remoteness. We must crane our necks to raise our eyes to his gaze. Calder's statue towers on City Hall, his pedestal. He looms immense, remote. How could he dream into being this wrangling city of brotherly love, this flawed commonweal? Was it through excess of zeal or the soul storm of an age our own cannot conceive? Who hasn't heard the tale? But time wears out our words, our ways of saying age as men do, grow incontinent and die. And history, that always wants another telling, puts before us the players, a choice of motives and their acts, what was given, what received, the facts or the presumed facts, but omits the chorus whose clear song extracts from the furor of their passions the truth of what is real.
I'm speaking with Dan Hoffman, if you're just joining us, and his historical poem on Penn's treaty with the Indians has just been published, and it's called Brotherly Love. We just heard an excerpt from that poem, and we'll be hearing a few more. You've alluded to the treaty that Penn signed with the Indians and to the fact that it ended in genocide, a very tragic ending to the treaty. Can you just describe a little bit what the nature of the treaty was more specifically, and what the ending, this genocidal ending to the treaty was, and how that affected William Penn's outlook?
Well, in fact, there were two treaties. The first one this indenture made the 15th day of July in the year of our Lord, according to the English accompt 1682, is the treaty that establishes the purchase of certain lands from this point to that point along the Delaware and the Wissahickon and the Neshaminy. I've reproduced the whole treaty. It goes on for several pages. It's a marvelous catalog of the things that were given. For instance, 40 hoes, 40 axes, 2 barrels of powder, 200 bars of lead, 200 knives, 200 small glasses, 12 pairs of shoes, 40 copper boxes, 40 tobacco tongs, 2 small barrels of pipes, 40 pair of scissors, 40 combs, 24 pounds of red lead, 100 awls, 2 handfuls of fish hooks, and so on for several pages. Then we see the said Indian sachem makers party to these presents as well for and on the behalf of themselves as for and on the behalf of their respective Indians or people for whom they are concerned, have granted, bargained, sold, and delivered, and by these presents do fully, clearly, and absolutely grant, bargain, sell, and deliver unto the said William Penn, his heirs and assigns, forever all that or those tract or tracts of lands lying and being in the province of Pennsylvania aforesaid, beginning at a certain white oak in the land now in the tenure of John Wood, and so on, and it defines the land. And at the end, I give the signatures of the dozen Indian chiefs who signed it. These were copied. I copied them by hand from the actual document in the Historical Society of Pennsylvania. Well, as it turned out, about 75 years later, Penn's son, Thomas, who was the, well, he had several sons, but Thomas is the main one here, who never came and lived in America, backslid from the Quakers, and married a lady with a title and had to drive a coach and four, he decided that he needed more money. And his agents in this country, in the colony, cooked up a little scheme in which they maintained that there was a lost deed that William Penn had signed with the Indians that guaranteed the settlers the possession of another 750,000 acres. They produced such a deed, and the Indians pondered it for 3 years and finally agreed to it. The deed said that the way the confines of the territory would be determined was that it was as much land as a man can walk in a day and a half. And little did the Indians know that the proprietor's agents had cleared a trail through the forest with their axes and had hired three marathon runners to do this. And consequently, they ran far in excess of what the Indians thought they were giving, that they were granting for this spurious deed. Now, this betrayal of the Indians is known in history as the Walking Purchase. And I've dramatized the whole circumstance of the Walking Purchase in a kind of ghost play. I have the spirit of Chief Newton has come and knock on the grave of James Logan, who was the secretary to the Penn Estate here, and wake him up and try to rescind the treaty. And then the treaty is reenacted, and the spirits cannot rescind the treaty, and history inexorably moves on. When the Indians realized what had happened to them, they naturally sided with the French as the French and Indian War approached. The Quakers in the provincial assembly refused to be taxed to extirpate the Indians, and they stepped down from public positions, and the colony inexorably went on toward its war against the Indians. You know, I've mentioned that I felt that there was in history the shape of a poem, could one only find it. At one point, I found myself reading in Penn's Code of Laws his provision to give bounties to the Indians who brought in the scalp or the feet of a wolf. And then a year and a half later, I find myself reading a war proclamation in which the military governor of the province is offering a bounty to the settlers who bring in the scalp of an Indian. And opposing parallel frames the third section of my poem.
So was Penn changed by this betrayal?
He was dead by that time.
Oh, he was dead by then.
He didn't know it, no.
Okay. So you've written this historical poem that you've been working on for 15 years. It's a long work. Was it hard to find a publisher? Because I don't think that long historical poems are really in vogue right now.
Well, I hope to change that with brotherly love. Well, I was very fortunate. I had a publisher who was interested in it. They'd published my last book, The Center of Attention, and it's Random House, and they've done a very lovely production job on the book.
You've also written a book about Poe, who also lived for a while in Philadelphia.
That's right. That's right.
Do you see any connections between the two?
Well, I guess there must be. I think with Poe, I was attempting an exploration of the inner life, the psychological inner life of a man who, over 100 years ago, seemed to foreshadow the modern condition in many ways. Curiously, what I had to do for Penn was to provide him with an inner life. It's a very different kind of inner life from Poe's. But as a Philadelphian, Penn represents the public life, the founder of the institutions that we live in. So in both cases, I was really attempting to go back to origins and sources. But it is very curious that I really had to imagine what was Penn's convincement like, what was his religious experience. Quaker historians tell us that the diary is a typical Quaker form. In fact, the whole business of creating a style for a poem about a Quaker is a rather tricky thing. The Quakers came into being at the time of the corruption of the Restoration Court, when the stage was very licentious and the poetry of the Earl of Rochester was popular, very libidinous poetry, and they were really quite puritanical in putting down all that kind of thing. So I had to search my soul for a style or a series of styles that would reflect that aspect of of the Quakers, but at the same time be interesting. And in the event, I've tried various things. I have a kind of conversational couplet that serves as the commentary. But as I said earlier, I was trying to peel the unpeel the onion of truth here and see these events as they have come down to us. Now, it isn't true that there's something in history 300 years ago and there's us today and we look at it and that's what we see. We see it as the people then saw it and as people since then have seen it. And that explains my fascination with the two paintings, one done in the 1770s and the other in the 1830s. I also have written a poem about the naval exploits of Penn's father, who was an admiral, in the style of Dryden, who was alive at the time and did write a poem about that very battle, but it was a very different poem. I've used period styles from time to time to indicate the historical resonance of the whole thing, the way it is part of our awareness of the depth and the complexity of the past.
Having written and researched this historical poem, do you find that you're thinking about different things when you walk down the street and see, say, the statue of William Penn on the top of City Hall, or see another historical landmark that's been alluded to in your poem?
Well, I'm sure that all this reading has given me a much richer sense of the complexity of history of all time. I took a year off and immersed myself in historical reading. Then I had to forget about it for a year because it was just too much to deal with. History is far too ramified. And while, as I say, I'm trying to reveal the poem that's hidden in history, it's rather like a sculptor with a huge tree trunk or a great block of granite who is trying to find the image that is secreted within it. You have to chip away a great deal. And I had to do this. I had to let many of the specific things just fade from memory so that I could sort out which were the essential ones for my purpose.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps we can close this discussion with a reading from the end of your poem.
Well, I'd like to do that. This really is a continuation of the opening reading. It picks up the same stanza and then ends that poem. On City Hall, above our lights, Penn's statue spreads indulgent arms, still beckoning the Welsh, the Mennonites, toward his green outlying farms. I must interrupt myself to say that when I come to the word seed at the end of this poem, it's a reference to the Quaker doctrine of the seed of light, the divine truth. His head in the clouds, his mood benign, those slum blocks sprawl, splotches of rot across Penn's wood. Beyond bulldozers snarl, as behind his back high-rise investments abruptly obtrude on our only noble boulevard proportioned to delight men's eyes. We cram the days, put time to use, no hour but is a rush hour, and we're rushing. Our history grows longer, longer. It's life that's getting away from us as the city changes, seethes with being. Our founder's feet are stuck to the cranium of a clock whose four faces gaze on us unseeing. Yet there's a spirit in this place that sifts through hands that clasp what only time can grasp. Here possibilities of grace, like fragrance from rich compost, cling to leaves where our each deed and misdeed fall. The seed stirs, even now is quickening.